Okay. This is the UVic Military Oral History Program with Herbert Matthews, recorded on March 17th at Herbert's house, interviewed by Janelle Jazerski. Lieutenant Matthews, do I have your permission to record this interview?
I think it's March the 12th. What did you say?
Oh, did I say 17th? It is March the 12th, 2014. Yes. Okay. All right. I'll see you. And Lieutenant Matthews, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes, but we'll do that.
All right. Great. Okay, I'm going to start with some background questions. Where were you born?
March the 16th, 1922.
Where was that?
It was at Alert Bay, just on the north part of, just off the north of Vancouver Island.
What did your parents do for a living?
At that time of birth, my dad was chief of police there, and that was what he did for a living. Then later on, he lost his position as chief of police, and during the Depression, where he was on relief, so he was feeding five kids off relief. I brought up the hard way.
No kidding. What was your educational background before enlisting?
Matriculation, university matriculation, 1941.
How old were you when you enlisted?
19.
19 years old. What were your reasons for enlisting?
I'd been pals with a chap who lived just almost next door in the Courtney Hotel in Courtney. His father owned it. And he was talking about joining the Air Force, and I was talking about the Air Force. It looked like a way to go during the war. But he left early. He went over to England and joined the RAF, the RAF. And he was killed during training over there before I actually joined the Air Force. So I knew he'd met his death training. But anyway, I decided that I'd join the Air Force, so I joined the Air Force.
Where have you go? What did you do for work before you enlisted?
At the age of 13, I started working in Lang's Drugstore in Courtney, B.C., and I worked there for 6 years, after school and Saturdays. Then I also played sports. I was 6'1". When I was about 13, 14 years old, and I weighed about 130 pounds, and I played center at basketball. I was a good center because I could outjump any kid. Okay. that was it. Also played soccer and lacrosse, and basketball. But that was at my school, and I matriculated from Courtney High, 1941, September.
Where did you enlist?
I enlisted in Vancouver. A group of us went down together. I think it was Norman Swan, who was later killed. Noel McPhee, who was later killed in the war. And I think one of the Moore boys and I, all from Courtney, went down and joined up together in Vancouver. To our surprise, we thought we'd go home again. But they shipped us off to Toronto, to the Manning Depot in Toronto, where they were pooling all these young men who wanted to be air crew. Then from there, they didn't have any room for us in the Commonwealth training program that had just been set up. And I did guard duty at Trenton Airport, marching around to a sergeant major type who was ordering us, just to keep us busy, I guess, around the parade square. I remembered all the commands, and later on I became parade adjutant at various stations I belonged to, which was the head guy on the parade force. I was an officer then. But a good job I remembered. Remember the first part of training had nothing to do with the Air Force.
Really?
Yeah.
So were they just waiting for there to be room in the
Commonwealth training? Yeah, I was waiting. The first school was Trenton. It was called Initial Training School, an ITS. Went there, we started. We didn't know what we were going to be at that time. We were all just airmen. We were taking link trainer courses and various courses in navigation, very simple. And the station commander, I got known that there, I guess there'd be about 150 of us in the class that was going through there, and the station commander let it be known that he needed six of us to go to observer school. Well, all these young guys were dead set on flying fighter planes, you know. So six of us got together and said, "Oh, we'll volunteer." And I remember us, a little gang of six. And so when we were at Parade Square, commander, "Have we any volunteers for observer school?" And six of us stood up. Six of us stood forward, okay? A roar of cheers went from the rest of the gang. So we were off to observer school. The first one was in Edmonton. It was called OTS, an observer first training school. And it was in the middle of winter. And I've born and lived on the coast here all my life. Mm. And they're training us in old ants and two engine aircraft with civilian pilots. And they're open and real cold, 25 below up there. So that was my first introduction to the Air Force. It was a real cold beginning.
Oh, I bet.
From there, we went to Bombing and Gunnery School in Lethbridge, Alberta. And the only thing I remember about Lethbridge is that they had a roller skate. I like roller skating. They had a roller skating hall that they held up the roof by beams around in the hall. And you had to be very careful if you were skating backwards not to run into a beam. But in Lethbridge, one of my friends who joined up with me, it was a gunnery school. We flew in old, what were they, ferry battles. And there was a pilot's cockpit, and then there's a cockpit behind where you could stick a couple of guys with a machine gun and to shoot at a drogue. Another plane would pull this drogue along. And I was friendly with a chap from Courtney here by the name of Norman Swan. So towards the end of the course, he says, "You know, Bert," he says, "I won't be able to finish this course." He says, "I want to go with the rest of you guys," but he says, "I got a terrible cold." I said, "I can't get up there today. This is the last gunnery practice." He says, "Those civilian pilots don't know who they got anyway. You put on that helmet and you pull out your jacket and you go up and do my shooting for me." So, okay, all right. I went up and he came out with a better score than I did gunnery school, but that got him into, he remained as a group and went overseas.
When did you start flying for the RAF?
Well, that was the Commonwealth Training Program I was in, the RCAF and the RAF and the Australian Air Force and New Zealand Air Force. We're all grouped in training, mm-hmm. grouped training in Canada.
I see, yeah.
Yeah, so it was quite a number of young men. From Lethbridge, where did I go to? I went to Rivers, Manitoba, and this was an astro navigation school. We flew there. The only thing I can remember about Rivers, and besides completing the course, was that it was terrible weather there. It was thunderstorms. Finished Rivers, Manitoba, then we'd had our, what we're observers were supposed to have, we had our navigation training, we had our gunnery training, and we had our bombing training also at Lethbridge, so that finished that part. Went home, was expecting to then be posted overseas, so then we're posted to the Manning Depot in Toronto, which was in the CNE. It was an old cattle barn. They'd converted this old cattle barn into various bunks, and there's rows and bunks of guys all there. Some are from the east and some are from the west, and there's always a holler at night, down with the west and down with the east or something. And then from there, we took this training at Trenton, and then the training at ITS, Initial Training School, and so on. That was the finish of it all. Sorry, I get it mixed up. But anyway, I did get from, I was posted to the Manning Depot there from Vancouver. When I got in to Vancouver, I had a certain amount of kit. I had two kit bags and a carry-on case. So the carry-on strap-on bag, I just had a change of underwear and a towel, and my dad was good enough to give me one of his straight razors and a strap to sharpen it on. Coming across Canada, I just about took my own life trying to use a straight razor for the first time on a wobbling train. When we got into Montreal, we were with my kit bags. That's right. I had two kit bags with flying gear and ordinary uniforms. And the chap, when I was getting on the train in Vancouver, says, "Oh, you silly bird! Don't pack those on. Just go check them. Go take your bag and check them." "Oh, okay. Check them." Got a little check in the bag. And when I got off at Montreal, I went to the wicket to get my two kit bags. I said, "They're not here." I said, "Why are they not here?" He said, "Well, they're on another train behind you. They're coming in." And he says, "Your fellows are all going to the same place. You're all going to Halifax. We'll just put them on the train to Halifax. You'll pick them up in Halifax." "Oh, okay." So we had a few hours, and we took a tram around Montreal and then back to the station. Then Halifax, got off the train again. I went over to pick and my checks for two kit bags. "They're not here." I said, "What happened to them?" "Oh," he said, "when all those bags came in, we knew you guys are going to go out tonight." I forgot the name of the ship. And he says, "You're going out tonight for sure, and we just sent everything down to the ship." Oh. I've come all the way across Canada in two sets of underwear by now. And then I went on to the ship. That was fine. Went and saw the duty officer. I said, "I'd like to be able to pick up my kit bag so I get a change of underwear and stuff." "Oh," he said, "they're down the hold." He said, "I'll go speak to the deck officer or somebody, and you'll go down the hold." I went down the hold of this big ship, and the front part was all loaded with kit bags and boxes and everything. It looked like a mile high of stuff. Wow. I'll never find my kit bags in there. So I said, "Holy cow. I've just got two changes of underwear, and I'm on the ship, and I just came across Canada," and that took about 4 days, and I'm here, and I got a towel and a piece of soap, and so I'm up, and I'm talking to one of them. I said, "You know, I haven't got my kit with me," and I went down to try to get it, and it's just impossible here. "Oh," and he says, you want to get a bath?" And I said, "Oh, gee, I'd just love a bath." He said, "Well, the way we do it here is we're being NCOs, just sergeants and so on. We sneak up to the officer's deck, and we see an officer leaving his place there. And if you go into the officer's cabin, you'll find that he has a private bath." So I thought, "Oh, this is great." So I had my towel and my soap, and I spotted one guy leaving his place. I guess he's going for lunch or something. Nipped into his place. They couldn't lock the doors. There's some reason, I guess, in the case of the ship was hit with a torpedo or something. But anyway, went in, and he turned on that nice tub of hot water and threw my underwear in there, and got in there and got my soap. "Soap doesn't lather. What's wrong with this soap?" "It's salt water. It's hot salt water."
Have
you ever had a bath in salt water? No, probably not. Anyway, Now I'm salted. I'm salty water. I got salted underwear, which I gotta wear, and so I'm pretty miserable. But I'm back on that. We're going into up the Clyde to, I forgot the name of the port in Scotland, and so we're getting off there, and we have the usual lecture by some officer from the RAF that we're all airmen over here to do our fighting and do our duty, etc., etc. My duty didn't bother me. What was bothering me is I didn't have a bath. So you know, this little train, you know, English trains, little cubicles. Mm-hmm. And of course, I didn't have any kit bags to get on there with. So I just got on and a little bag, and we went all the way right from Scotland right down to the end of England to Bournemouth. And I got into Bournemouth just with what I had, and went and saw the station adjutant and said, "I've lost all my kit." He said, "I need some new kit right away." And, oh, he said, "No problem." He gave me a slip. He said, "You go over to stores and get it." So I went over to stores, and of course, all English stuff now. I got English labels mm-hmm. all over me. I'm a Canadian, but I got English uniforms. That's fine. Had a beautiful bath and put on all my English stuff, and then the the station seemed relatively empty. A whole bunch of us guys came in here, and now there's nobody around. Apparently, a draft had come in for bomber command, and they moved all these guys into various bomber units. The pilots and the observers and the gunners and all, we come over, and I'm just left there. And the adjutant said to me, he says, "We couldn't ship you out right away because I had to get all the work done for that kit, your kit and stuff." He says, "But there's a posting to Coastal Command." I said, "It's up at Silloth. You know, that's just short of Carlisle near Scotland." I said, "Yeah." He says, "I'll give you the railway warrants and you go up there and that's where you're going." Okay, so he gave me two kit bags, and I was quite happy and got on the train up, well, way up. And as I was getting on the train, the conductor said, "Oh, laddie," he says. I said, "Yeah." He says, "You can't take those bags on the train if there's an air attack or something, and those bags are laying around in the aisles, so people are not going to get off that train." "Oh," he says, "you put them in the baggage car right back there." I said, "Okay." So I put my two kit bags in the baggage car, and I got on the train. And when I got up to Silloth, no, it's actually at Carlisle. I went to get my kit bags, and I went along the train, and the baggage car just completely disappeared. There's no baggage car. What happened to the baggage car? So the guy said, where are the baggage car?" "Oh," he said, "we dropped that off at, I think it was Carlisle or someplace on the line." Oh. So, okay, well, okay. I went into cell and reported to the adjutant there, and I'm arrived. I haven't got my Canadian kit, and I haven't got the English kit they gave me in Bournemouth. I says, I need a change. I need new uniforms. I need everything, flying gear, everything." "Oh," he said, "here's another one of these warrant slips I took." So I got another two kit bags of stuff. That's fine. I'm quite happy there. And I met a staff sergeant by the name of Luker. And we got talking. He says, "You know what?" He says, "I'm trying to put a crew together." He says, "I'm an ex-instructor, and I'm going to go operational." He says, "So I kind of like you." I said, "How about you and I crewing up together?" And I said, "Sure, we'll just go." He said, "I'll go and fix it up with everybody, and you'll be part of my navigator." So he went there, and then he came back. He says, "You know what they want to do? They want to send you off on a bombing leaders course." "Oh," I said, "but," he said, they'll ultimately send you on a bombing leaders course. But he said, "In the meantime, we're going to do our training here together." So as I was training then there, my two Canadian kit bags showed up. That was nice. And then the two kit bags from that they got in Bournemouth, they showed up. And I had two kit bags from the local, from Silla, so now I had six kit bags. So that was nice. So I trained with this chap who did my navigation, astro navigation with him, and we were good friends. He said, "Oh," and then the adjutant got home. He says, "Matthews, it's time you're going on that bombing leaders course." "Oh," I said, "okay." I was having much fun with the guys who were there. "Okay, take off." He says, I'll give you all the railway warrants. It's on the other side of England near the Wash. Oh, okay. I said, okay, I'll just take what I need. What will I need? Flying gear and change. He said, no. He says, you take it all. You take all your kit. You don't leave anything here at this station. He says, because you're belonging to 120 Squadron now. It's over in Ireland. He says, I don't know where they're going to post it exactly, but you're part of 120 Squadron. Oh, so, okay. So I said, thank you. He says, I'll give you the railway warrants and away you go off to bombing leader school. So I got 6 kit bags, and the first big, I got them on the train at Silloth, and I got off at Carlisle. Now, Carlisle is a pretty big train station, and the tracks, I don't know if you've ever seen an English train, they have walkways over the tracks. You go from one side by going over these walkways and down. So I got off the I-train on this side, and then, of course, the other train's on the other side now. So 6 kit bags over and across and down the other side onto the train to go south. And so that's fine. So I'm just, nobody said, don't take your kit bags here. So I stuffed these 6 kit bags under my seats and the little coaches they have in English. And I finally got down to the bombing meter school. So I went in. I think a trucker took me. A truck met me. And trucked me and my 6 kit bags. So I was a sergeant. I look at the school and all these guys are officers. I said, what am I doing here? All these guys are bombing. They're going to be bombing leaders. They're going to be head guys in their squadron. They're all Bomber Command, too. I've talked to most of them. They're all from Bomber Command. I can't find a guy from Coastal Command. Well, so the guy said, you'll have to go into the sergeant's area and we'll put you there. So I went to the sergeant's area and stuff. The bunk was just big enough to take 6 kit bags underneath. So all these other guys were looking at me. The bloody rich Canadian, he travels with 6 kit bags. So I did the course, and then of course I got to take these 6 kit bags now. Nobody wanted them. So back up to, I found out by that time we'd been posted over to Ireland. So back up, I had to go through Silloth, and there was, I forgot the name of the little town where the ferry was over to Ireland. Lugged everything over to Ireland, lugged it out to the station where I was, and went in the sergeant's area, got myself a bunk, and stuffed all my stuff under there. The adjutant one day said, Matthews, he says, you're improperly dressed. I said, what do you mean? He says, you're an officer. Why are you running around in sergeant's clothes for? Oh, when was I an officer? He says, you were an officer ever since you left Canada. I said, I didn't know. Nobody told me. He says, not only are you an officer, you were a pilot officer, but now your time's gone by, you're a flying officer. Oh, that's nice to know. So, okay, that's good. So I said, now I have a small problem. I'm with a crew. We got a nice crew with Luker, and so he's had to join up with another guy who's going to take over as our captain. That's fine. I got all these kit bags of clothes. He says, under the King's regulations, when you become an officer, you're entitled to turn in one set of sergeant of your regular uniforms and stuff. Just one set? He says, yeah. Okay, so I got this crew, I think there's 9 or 10 of us together. I said, tomorrow night you're going to come to my place and I'm going to give you all my clothes that I can spare. So I put all this kit out, and there's underwear, there's socks, there's boots, there's that flying. And so you guys help yourselves. And I just saved one set for myself and all this very happy crewmen. We got all the spare stuff, so that was fine. That was the beginning of starting operations there. It was a chap by the name of Flying Officer Weber who took over this infant crew and with Luker as a co-pilot. Mm-hmm. We're at Alder Grove, and then we're going to, because 120 Squadron, we did some training there, sort of in squadron training. And then I thought we were going to, there's going to be a large detachment of us sent up to Iceland. So just our luck, our crew was the group, and the main body of us all went up to Iceland, to Reykjavik. So we're on long-range liberators, or actually they could call it very long-range liberators, VLR liberators. They're four-engine Pratt & Whitney's. They would stay up for about 18 hours. They took out one set of bomb bays on one side and put in a huge tank to hold petrol. I forgot the number of gallons that went into there. Crew had been stripped down from the bomber command type liberator. They'd taken out the upper gun turret. It had a .5 machine gun in the nose, no turret. They left on the rear gun turret on these liberators. They were a highly reliable aircraft. We could do about 18 hours with the extra tank in the bomb bay. The flight engineer had to pump from this extra tank to the wing tanks to keep the airplane balanced during flight. That was his main job. His other main job was to keep an eye on the two pilots to make sure they didn't go to sleep. So so there was always three men, and there was another man on the upper deck in the cabin, a wireless operator, and he was always, and oh, sure, there was another guy on the radar. So there'd be five people on the main deck. I was down in the nose. The navigator's position was in the nose. And it's like a small office. I had a proper desk, and I could for charts and doing. And I had a drift meter and a bubble sextant. And of course, we're navigating in the days when there's no global positioning or nothing like that. You're strictly on your own brains and your own tools out there to navigate. A navigator's position with the drift meter meant that the rear gunner in the rear turret at night would have to put down a flare that would show light so you could go back and forth at various courses to get a triangulation to find out what the wind speed was and the wind direction. And of course, and it would be a smoke type thing during the day and a light at night. That was only one way we could get wind speed that way. There was no other way to do it. You had to do it by triangulation on what was called a little Dalton computer. It wasn't a computer, it was a little box. You could turn a knob and move the screen around a little bit and do your triangulation right there and get your wind direction and speed. We were all trained metrologists, met the guys. We had cards we had to fill out all the time, every hour, as to what the position was, what the sky looked like, what the sea looked like, wind direction and speed. And if the aircraft went down to get a reset the altimeter at sea level, because this always varied with the barometric pressure, so that all had to go on your MET card. I didn't know about that until afterwards. These cards were very important. We'd take them into the MET man, and these were what Bomber Command were basing their attack data for going over Europe. These cards are coming in from us guys flying out over the Middle Atlantic. I guess in all, the crew, the gunners, I felt kind of sorry for them. The rear gunner, that was a pretty, tireless job. It was, and then We had two spare guys. We had two sets of side guns. There was a window they could drop down, and these are .3s, .303 guns strapped together. And we really didn't need this over the Atlantic because nobody was going to attack us. But there was flights where we had to go up the Norwegian coast for Russian convoys to protect them, so that we needed guns over that way. But out in the mid-Atlantic, and our main job was to do the middle of the Atlantic, from either side, from Canada and from the UK, they could do a bit of the Atlantic, okay, but left a very large gap in the middle. And that would be our main job, was to get out there, where the job was split into two parts, really. One was suppression. People forget about this. We were out there to suppress the U-boats, so they wouldn't come up to the surface to see any of the convoys or the troop ships. And the other course was to attack them. When I first joined the squadron, the U-boat's only defense was to dive. An aircraft was going to attack, they'd have to dive and get out of the way. And hopefully, the pilots at that time were dropping the depth charges, and that sort of have to guess where that darn thing went to get the depth charges, usually four of them, spaced out at 200 feet. So it would be a 200-foot stick of depth charges, just four of them. And then we packed eight, so there's just two sticks. So that was the first one was there, and the pilots did all the dropping of the depth charges. But when I got there, they brought in what was called the bomb three, low level bomb sight, the Mark III low level bomb sight. I'd taken courses as a bombing leader and also courses on bomb sites, so somebody will have some understanding in future. The Mark III low-level bomb sight was a clever little device, and I think it actually won the war, so far as it's concerned. When you walk along and you put your arm out in front of you, and you sight an object on the floor, and as you walk towards it, your arm comes down, sighting along your arm will come down slowly, but it's coming down faster now as you get near the object, okay? Now, this bomb sight was based on what's called the speed of a radian. So the speed of that dropping and the speed that faster it goes, the arm goes as you get near the object, that speed was used in this little bomb sight to be the point where you could release the depth charges so they'd fall across a U-boat. And it was a marvelous little thing. If you take I don't know if you've ever seen it, if you take a cube and cut it around, a tin can, and cut it all around like a screw.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and you put a light in it, okay, and you can turn it, and the lines will actually move.
Hmm.
Okay, but that's the principle is, the light was shone onto a piece of glass, just an ordinary piece of glass, and that piece of glass was always stable, was held by gyroscopes in one stable position, no matter what the aircraft did, it's always in one stable position, so on a bombing run, you could go in. But the beauty about it is that on a bombing run, I found out that this little piece of glass and these lines moving, when the lines moved and your target moved at the same speed you released, that split second,
okay,
the lines and the target move at the same release. Well, I found out that the gyros were very, very powerful to hold this piece of glass in the right angle at all times. So you could take an aircraft and you could do a roller coaster up and down, like going on a roller coaster when you're attacking a U-boat. So we'd get off and we'd then do a roller coaster attack. Okay, that was great.
Okay.
And there's reports later the gunners on the U-boat just went about crazy trying to sight us as you come in this way. But the so the one to that was one thing. I had to train all the navigators, because I was a bombing leader, to how to use this Mark III bomb sight. And they got pretty good. We got pretty good. I was exceptional at it. I could hit a target, just a little square floating raft,
wow,
14 times out of 15 with a practice bomb. But I trained them all, and these boys were keen. They could do it. But there's only one big problem. If somebody's shooting at you, it's a little bit of a distraction. Especially tracers. It's tracers coming at you look like silver tennis balls. So I had to train these chaps to just set their mind on one thing. Now, this is a real hard job. On one thing. The only one thing you have to do is to keep your mind on it, is to, when that line and that target move at the same speed, release. If you don't release at that point, you'll overshoot. If you release too soon, you'll undershoot. So I got all the navigators, they're a good bunch of fellows, they are all trained. And I no sooner finished training them to do that, and then they brought in what's called a Lee light. I don't know if they're, it's a great, it's 12 million candle power searchlight. And it was strapped to the right wing, the starboard wing of the aircraft. No, it'd blind you. So yeah, so now this is, so that it's strapped out there and it could swivel and it could do anything, it could move. And we had a huge set of batteries now in the aircraft. So now I had to train the fellows how to use, and it was on a bicycle control. You turn it this way, or up and down to control this big light. So the idea was, you'd pick up, we'd go out at night, they go at night, you'd pick up a U-boat on the radar, and the radar operator would call the, there was a yardage dial on his radar, and when you got to 1,000 yards, you'd turn on, the navigator would turn on this light, and sweep at the position and pick up the object, okay, the U-boat, but you had to attack straight on now. You could not go up and down anymore in self-defense. So you would attack this way. And I thought one night we're sent into an area which is called a restricted area for other vessels. The only thing you'll find in that area will be a U-boat. There'll be nothing else. If you're out there that night, so we were out there, the British intelligence were picking up stuff and were... we didn't know anything about. So we're out there, and a radar operator got contact, and he gave it 1,200 yards. So I fell flat in my face down on the controls. Got the bombing panel ready, because you had to do all this. Select the stick of bomb, stick of depth charges. And we're running out. He said, 1,000 yards. So turn on the light, sweeping along. Well, there's the object out there. I got it! And we're running straight in on this thing. And our light's right, and there's nothing coming up back up. There's no flak. There's no machine gun fire. The U-boats are fully armed by now. Nothing coming at us at all. I said, holy cow, there's something wrong here. That U-boat should be firing its head off by now. And we kept going on. I better wait and see what I've got. So it was a trawler, and all the men were standing on deck, and their faces were glowing white with this light shining on them. That's the only night attack I did. And good job I didn't drop anything.
Yeah.
The day attack was in mid-Atlantic. That's what we're supposed to be doing, and we saw another plane attacking a U-boat, and he had dropped his stick off to one side, so he missed. So our pilot then drove down. He dove down to get this U-boat before it dived. We thought it'll dive. No siree. This guy was fully armed. He had a bandstand on the back of the conning tower of machine guns and anti-aircraft guns, and he was peppering at that this guy, the first guy who went through. This is the first time I ever saw any aircraft flak or anything. So we dived down, and we were too long. We were too high and too long, so our first stick went over the top. The other guy swung around. He came back in again. They had to go through this fire. I know the poor guy. Mm-hmm. I could feel it too. So he's trying to get through this anti-aircraft machine gun fire, and he's off to one side again. So this U-boat is merrily going along. It's now had three sticks of depth charges dropped on or near it, but it's not stopping. It's going. So I said, the skipper said, "Well, we'll have to get him." I said, "Well, we'll have to get him." He said, "Well, we'll have to do a." Yeah, I said, "He's fully armed. That's for sure." I said, "We got to get down." So he said, "We're going to go right on the bow. We're going to do a bow attack." Okay, so, well, we'll go right out. We'll make a proper run at it. He's not going to dive, so let's go. So we're running in, doing an undulating this up and down like a roller coaster. The flak actually is it bursts. It's black powder. It's black. He's getting near, but he's not hitting us. And we're getting down onto him. I said, "Well, we'll get him this time." And as we're coming in onto his bow, onto his nose, he's then slowly turning. Okay, he's trying to get his conning tower's in his way, and so he's getting his conning tower out of the way so he can bring all his guns to bear on us. So we're doing our roller coaster entrance, and the little bomb, Mark III bomb sight, is doing its little job. So this time, so he's slowly turning, and he's firing. So I said, "Bert, you can't think about that. You're the bombing leader. You got to get this guy. You know, your reputation will be ruined if you don't." So we got in and got over the top of him, and he's machine gun fired about 100 to 120 feet, I guess, we'd be over the top of him. And the rear gunner says, hollered out, you got him!" So that was, we laid two depth charges on either side of him. And then that stopped him. Mm-hmm. That was it. So he's now stopped, and one of the side gunners put down this panel and was using a .303 machine gun firing at us. And I went back with the camera, and I said, "Stop firing, it's useless." And I think 19 men came out of the conning tower with a rubber raft. By that time, two British small warships, like frigates, came alongside, and they were picking up the 19 men that came out of the conning tower. And it was too late. That's all that could get out. I think 35 men went down with the U-boat. And that was fine. We did what we were supposed to do. We sank a U-boat in mid-Atlantic. That was number U-635, we found out after the war. Captain Spieling was the captain of the U-boat. He had a doctor on board. I guess I shouldn't use the guy's name.
Yeah, that's okay.
They had a doctor on board. And two British small type destroyers, more like frigates, came by and picked up the 19 chaps who got off. The other 35 went down. We found out later, the captain was telling we was on his interview, he said it was the last guy attacked us who got us. Whoever that was, he got it. He got us. That was fine. That was fine. We got the pilot Weber was awarded the DFC almost immediately from Air Command. Then a few days later, they awarded me the DFC, and then at about the same time, they awarded the engineer, who was a non-commissioned officer, the AFC, Air Force Cross. And I recently, this is a strange reason. The reason they awarded him the Air Force Cross, and none of the other crew got any medals, was the engineer, when the bomb doors were open, they were on, remember the old-fashioned desks, you could open the cover? There was on the, sort of like a bicycle chain.
Mm.
So when the bomb doors were open, his job, he always packed a long screwdriver in his back pocket, was to go up and jam the screwdriver through the chain that controlled the doors, so the doors would not sink down when we on our roller coaster dive, because of terrific force, downforce. That was his job. And he'd have to do, in order to do that, he'd have to have 1 foot on one side in the main part, and 1 foot out near a little ledge where the bomb door was. And he'd straddle that and jam the screwdriver into this to hold the doors open. And his story was, when he got back to family, he said, I got the Air Force Cross because they didn't shoot off the family jewels. So he said, but he said it was something to watch that stuff flying by as you went in. At the time, then I got the DFC and at the time, it didn't bother me, the fact that I'd sunk a U-boat and we were part of a team that drowned 35 men. But some years later, my wife will tell you, that it started to bother me, and principally because I was religious. Ten Commandments, the old commandments, thou shalt not kill, and then later on they changed the shalt not do any murder. But that bothered me for quite a while, and then I had to rationalize the thing. Well, I was just doing my duty, and if I didn't do my duty, and I would be the guy down at the bottom of the sea. Looking back, that was a bit of a strain for a few years. I know about that. My wife's brother Chandler was in the Princess Pat Infantry. He was a sniper, and he was killing Germans face to face, and he had a lot of trouble after the war. I imagine a lot of guys had some similar trouble. That was that one night attack, and that particular attack was the only time I did any real attacking. All the other time, it was hour after hour, the Princess Mary and the Queen Elizabeth, the big troop ships, and the, a couple of Dutch ones and American ones, we'd be sent out to what's called suppression to hold down U-boats. And we'd spend hours in areas, you know, we wouldn't see a thing. We could occasionally pick up these big ships on the radar, but and I'm sure the troops on there never knew that there was an aircraft around them at all, doing any protection. That was one job. Another job was to patrol what we call the Rosengarten. That's the area between Iceland and the Faroes. And the U-boats had to come through there to get out into the Atlantic, all right? But the trick was to keep them suppressed there as well, so they couldn't take on air. They needed air to run their diesel, you know, and for everything. So we'd spend nights out just doing what's called a square search, just back and forth in this area to make sure they were suppressed. That was the other job. In all, I did over 550 hours flying. We were short of navigators. I flew with my own crew and every crew on the squadron. I was an assistant navigation officer. One of my other duties was to go out with new crews, new navigators. And it's quite to go up and navigate for 18 hours or something, or just about that or something, about 16, 18 hours. By this time, they were sending out, there's two navigators now. So I would go out, I would be asked to go out as a, I guess, called a safety navigator. One of the worst experiences, I decided these two young men were doing pretty good navigating. We're on our way home from up north of the Hebrides into Northern Ireland, and I dozed off, and I woke up, and I went and looked at the chart, and I said, "Yeah, where I got the course laid out for home." Mm-hmm. And I said, "That's it there." He says, "Yes, that's there." I said, "How high are we?" He said, "We're flying at 1,000 feet." I said, "That you just drew a line through a mountain there. That's 1,200 feet." I thought 1,200. Yeah. I said, "We're just about 500 feet below its crest." So I called up to the pilot and said, 90 degrees starboard now. And everybody woke up in this big, huge aircraft, thrown up on its side. And I said, "Hold it until we give you a course." And so, you know, then I said, "Well, time, I know where we are. We time it now, we get in the better course back home over the sea." I said that one of the first things about navigating when you're in coastal command is to stay over the sea. Don't ever get over land if you can possibly avoid it. So when we got down, I said, "What was all that about? 90 degrees sudden?" "Oh," I said, "just a training exercise." That was a very dangerous one, that one. I used to know the name of the mountain, little hill there that we would have crashed into. But the other thing is, navigators, we were jacks of all trade. We do astro navigating, of course, doing navigating north of the Arctic Circle, north of 23 north. It's difficulty, of course. Compasses. We had a pretty good gyro compass on the Liberator. An ordinary compass wouldn't work at all. We had what's called an astro compass, which you'd attach when you're in the bubble, where you could use this 60-shot bubble sextant. So up north, getting north of Iceland, number one is, once you took off from Reykjavik, you'll never get back to Reykjavik. We'd have to land in northern Scotland. I only did one Russian convoy, and it was, we got up north, we got into position, we could hear the Russian, the Englishman on taking stuff into northern Russia, and it was all fogged in. And the pilot said to me, "Well, we should go down and see what we can see." I said, "No, we don't." And I said, "No." He said, "Why don't we?" I said, "We haven't been down to the sea level for hours. We don't know what the barometric pressure is, and our altimeter is probably a way out." I said, "We got radar, but we're not going to do any good down there anyway. Because if the we can't see them, the U-boats can't see them either." So, okay, I said, anyway, the engineers, we were running short on food, so we headed back to northern Scotland. That's only one I did up there north of the Arctic Circle. Tacking U-boats at night, one of my friends, a chap from Montreal, he attacked at night with a Lee light. They got a, and when they got down, it was two fully armed U-boats lashed together in the Atlantic, and that means they riddled his plane, they killed his navigator. He got back to northern Scotland. I saw the plane. We had to pick his crew up and bring him back to Ballykelly, which is one of our bases in Northern Ireland. And he got the Distinguished Service Order for bringing the plane in. It was just absolutely full of holes. It was looked like a piece of cheese, you know. But there were, just before I got onto the squadron, Wing Commander Longmore was the commander of the squadron, and this was, we didn't know at that time, but he had put a crew together, gone out, and he didn't show up, he just disappeared. So at that time, I was also the air sea rescue officer of the squadron. So we tried to plot out where he would be. We sent out a couple of aircraft to search the area, but the Atlantic is one big ocean. So we couldn't trace him. Afterwards, after the war, we found out he was probably one who suddenly discovered that U-boats were heavily armed now and was shot down.
What's the, did that have a lot of an impact on the morale? Things like this?
Well, it has an impact on morale. People know now that you're not just attacking a sitting target, a U-boat that can't do anything. His only defense is not... It used to be he could dive. That was his only defense. Now he can stand up and fight. I have a list of the armament they used to put on those bandstands, but there was heavy anti-aircraft exploding shells, as well as I guess it's a pom-pom type machine gun, machine guns that push out. It's about a bullet's about a half an inch to three quarters of an inch. And these would come at you. They'd look like the tracers. I guess they put one tracer in for every nine regulars. They look like silver tennis balls. It was sort of a slow motion sensation of these things traveling through the air. But we knew he'd been shot down. That was too bad. When you're in the service, you know you may get killed, okay? There is a chance. I knew that if I went to bomber command, my chances of being killed were very good. They're 1 in 3, okay? Going into coastal command, I thought I was home safe, okay? Well, you know, I'm not going to die because somebody shot me down. Accepted that we were a mixed squadron. We have Australians, New Zealanders, one Free Belgium who was a navigation officer, Irishman, we had an Irishman on our crew, South Africans. We had a mixture of fellows from all around the Commonwealth. And we all seemed to fit together. We had no, there was no animosity anywhere between anybody. We were just all knitted together as being part of the Commonwealth. For relaxation, we played cribbage or bridge, shove halfpenny.
You know, I don't know that, no.
It's a board. It has lines drawn across it like this. And you take a big English penny, mm-hmm. and you shove it up and you try to put it in between the lines.
Oh.
If it's on one, if it's not completely in the line, then you take another penny and you try to push it in, and you have 10 pennies. You say, well, I got 3 that time, and then your opponent would go ahead and say, oh, I got 4. You've got to buy me a beer. You know, but there wasn't much time. I didn't have much spare time at all. I'd no sooner get down than, because we're really short of astro-navigators, and I'd be told that, you know, the CO would say, Bert, you better get some rest. You're going to go up with so-and-so's crew in about 24 hours. That was it. I flew with everybody that I can remember. They all accepted me into the crew. Once we were airborne, there was no distinction between ranks and everybody on the gun on the plane. We were a working gang of individuals. That was it. We were a working gang, and the only thing that was, if there was some tough decisions had to be made, the captain had to make the decisions. If he wanted help, he could ask somebody for help on the decision. But generally speaking, the crews, the chaps I was flying with were all well trained as a crew. They were. I can't think of any animosity between any of the chaps at all. I don't remember anything of that nature.
Once you closed the Mid-Atlantic air gap, was there things that boosted morale?
We were boosted along at the basic thing. We were able to attack armed U-boats fairly successfully now with undulating run-ins and this Mark III low-level bomb site. That we didn't... When I was there, I think there was only one craft shot down and one craft riddled. And I was there on the squadron for almost 2 years. Mm-hmm. So having a better knowledge of what to do was how to attack helped out a great mm-hmm. deal. We knew we had a real good chance of getting away with it. Mm-hmm. When you think about it, we're about 300 men in all, including the ground crew, cooks, and air crew in Iceland. That was the... We're a fairly happy lot. Of course, we were really happy because the Americans left all their liquor there. The Americans moved in and left a... aircraft hangar, virtually an aircraft hangar full of liquor.
Wow.
But there's lots to drink, boy.
Shortage there.
But you had to be careful because, you know, you couldn't drink 24 hours before takeoff. Mm-hmm. And everybody had to be careful about that. And we have some pretty good parties when the place was fogged in completely. We enjoyed a good fog in all over the Atlantic. That was a good time. The worst thing I remember is that I drew up a modification for the I was expert in bomb sites for the Mark III low level bomb site, and I had an idea how to steady the chap down so his eye wouldn't drift up or down when he's watching the lines. And so there was an architect on the squadron, a chap, and I got, you know, he's always, see, I'd love to draw that up for you and we'll send it down to Air Ministry, whatever you have in mind. He said, I'll lay it all out for you, and he did a great job. We sent it all down to Air Ministry. I don't know what happened after that, but anyway, he was on a crew later on that was killed, so I was kind of sad about that. When they brought in the Lee Light, and I had to retrain all these navigators and using Leelight, very powerful. I couldn't get enough air time of spare aircraft to train these jets. I knew the engineer who was looking after the airplanes very well, and he said, "Bert, there's just nothing. I'll let you know anytime we have any spare for night work, you can have the aircraft." So, but it wasn't enough. I could see that taking a bicycle handle and moving a 12 million candle power light across the sea this way and that way and up and down. So I went to the station commander and said, I need to build a simulator for a Leelight. He says, "You what? I want to build a simulator for a Leelight." He says, "I need a whole Nissen hut." "Oh, but sure, you can have one." So I went to the instrument men. I said, "Are you interested in helping me? We're going to build a simulator for a Leelight." I said, "We've got to reduce everything down in size, get a place of absolutely dark room." I said, "I got that now, and we'll use just a model, do a scale model sub, and a track along, and we pull this thing across a track and bring it in towards the bomb site and the handles for the Leelight." I said, "Can you guys rustle up special?" I said, "I want the same handles that they're using on those Leelights." I says, "And we can get a spare bomb site. Doesn't matter whether it's working or not. That's not the part of it. It's be able to get the navigators to be able to flash this light around with ease." And so we built one of the instruments. That was a great idea. And so they give them something spare to do. And they did it. And the guys would go in there and train on this light. It didn't matter what day or night. It was pitch black in there. But it was the idea to get some idea of where things happen when you did things here, that this thing is going to go that way or this way. So, I don't know. The 120 Squadron, the group I was with, we sank or helped to sink 25 U-boats during the war. The Canadian Navy, the whole Canadian Navy, helped to sink or assisted in sinking 29 U-boats.
You guys are effective.
Yeah. And we got the King's, you saw it, we got the King's Standard. We were ranked with Gibson's Dam Buster Squadron for the amount contributing. But I always felt that the event of the Mark III low-level bomb site, which could adjust to this type of undulating attack, was one of the factors in being able to handle the U-boats in mid-Atlantic. That was a big factor. And the other big factor that everybody's, I've read a lot of books, they don't seem to dwell on much, is what I call suppression, is keeping the U-boats down, going over areas where they would be and keeping them down. It got so bad for the U-boats, and they used snorkels. They'd put up these air vents to get some air and still only leave a small trace on the surface. Now, in Atlantic, spotting U-boats, most of our spotting was done with radar, which was very good at short ranges. Also, I used the radar for landing in Iceland. Iceland has very rocky peninsula that's come out into the sea, and there's two airfields. One coming in, even if it's broad daylight, I'd tell the operator to get out of the radar. I'd get in there and I'd watch to see what it looked like on radar, how these peninsulas looked and in relationship to the airport. So that when Iceland was fogged in quite a while, many times, it was life or death to get down when you came in pretty near empty. to bring in, to tell a pilot, you know, to guide him into the airport off the radar. The Icelandic people, they were neither friendly or unfriendly. They worked for the airport, digging out ditches and keeping, doing sort of maintenance work. The Iceland, you get some time off. I went over and saw Gullfoss Falls, one of their main falls there. The Icelanders liked goat steaks. We're told when you go over there, you go over and walk, you have quite a bit of, you could take a jeep part way, but you had to walk quite a bit to get in to see these falls, and there was a farmhouse there. And they drop by there, and they'll cook you up a meal. But you went in there, and they, oh, yeah, sure, they cook up a meal, all right. It was goat steak. First time in my life I ever had goat steak.
Good.
But Gullfoss Falls in itself are quite a sight. I can't think. There was no social like life like they had in England, where you could go to dances and things like that. There was nothing like that.
Hmm.
And we didn't have any movies there that I can recall, you know. So that was total. You were pretty well isolated, but you were also very, very busy, so it didn't make much difference.
Did you have a lot of contact with your family while you were?
No. The city of Courtney sent me a package once, containing my favorite, which was peanuts. Well, by the time this package got to me, months later, the peanuts were rotten.
Oh, no.
So, and then another time I was... I'll leave Iceland in a moment. I was posted to the Bahamas later, but and nothing arrived. Mail. I don't know. I just didn't seem to get any mail. Although I had one of my sisters was in the Canadian Army. My brother wasn't. No, he was too young. But. Mail didn't seem to get through to us.
Mm.
And I don't know whether that was the fault of the ships being sunk, or it was just a simple fault of breakdown of the system over there. As for news, we could get some radio contact with England, but everything seemed to be... censored, in a sense that you really didn't know what was going on.
Mm.
I didn't know there were concentration camps. I didn't know the Japanese were all rounded up in Canada and shipped into internment camps. There's a lot of stuff I didn't know at the time at all. From Iceland, I was posted down to the Bahamas. I was their bombing leader down there. I was their air sea rescue instructor for how to stay alive at sea if you're knocked down, and as also the assistant armament officer, and also he gave me some other job. Oh, I was parade adjutant. I was the adjutant who looked after parades.
When was this that you were posted to the Bahamas?
Pardon?
When was this that you were posted to the Bahamas?
Bahamas just in 19. Beginning in 1944, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. And we're down there. I arrived there. We were training. It was an OTU off a training unit there, number 111, and operational training unit, and. The bombing leader, who was teaching bombing, had ran out of bombs, practice bombs, and he was then cutting down palm trees around the island and putting a nail in them and bending the nail over and hooking that onto the bomb rack, which has had a trip release, for practicing.
Mm.
So the it was, when I got there, there was no practice bombs, and there was no trees left. He cut down about every tree he could find. So I said to the CO, I said, you know, this is a little difficult. He says, well, it's difficult, Matthews. I says, Americans are not shipping in any practice bombs. And the previous instructor, bombing leader, cut down all the trees. And I said, I've tried to use some of the packing cases and sort of cut them up and nail them together and drop them, but I don't have more packing cases. And I said, well, it's a typical way of doing it. I'll just leave the problem with you.
Okay,
so that was a problem. So I guess the people thought I was going nutty down there, trying to find things to drop from the air to make a splash in the sea. That's all I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
There's some dropped flour, little bags of flour or sugar. There wasn't enough bags to drop bags of sand. So, terrible. So, I thought, well, I've got to get something to drop. It'll burst. And if they hit the motor launch that is towing the target, because we're after moving targets, I said, it won't hurt it. There was a lot of cardboard boxes around. Maybe I could devise a cardboard bomb. So I rolled around, tied it. I then thought, well, I went to the medical officer and I said, I want some French safes. He said, how many do you want? I said, I'd like about 144 gross. He said, okay. He said, you know, why do you want that? I said, I'm going to make some practice bombs. So I got a cardboard, rolled the cardboard up, and I've already had extensive training in bombs. I know if you leave the back end of a tube open, it'll drop straight. A lot of people wouldn't know this. Mm. So I got to put a plug over the front of the cardboard, put some string around so we can hang it onto the bombing rack, and put a nose on the front of it. Okay, and fill up the safe full of water. So I now had a bomb, a practice bomb. So we took this up. The only trouble, some of them worked all right, but the only trouble is when they hit the strips, the slipstream coming out of the bomb bay, the nose would get punched in. So I was devising a way to stop that from being punched in. And by that time, I guess the commanding officer probably thought I was going crackers. He says, the war's over in Europe. I said, yeah. What now? He says, you'll have to go in with the Americans now and be trained on a special new type of bomb site, a radar bomb site. He says, they'll be holding you to go to the Pacific. Oh. So the Americans had a place, they had it set up, they had this huge training thing. It was a radar bomb site, all right. The radar would pick up, you didn't have to have any light or anything. You'd fly along at night, this aircraft, the radar would pick up an object on the sea, you didn't know what it was, okay? And then at a set height and a set distance, it would release the depth charges or bombs to hit whatever's on the sea. So we were going to go over and really surprise the Japanese. They were going to have a devil of a job figuring out what was hitting them at night. Then they dropped the atomic bomb, and that sort of, I was sent home. Yeah, that was it. I was sent home for embarkation leave to go to the Far East with a squadron that's going to be put together by the British. And when I was home, they dropped the atomic bomb on August the 6th. And that of course, finished the war. And I met Highness here, my wife, on August the 4th. I was home at that time, 1946. Yeah.
Do you have time for a few concluding questions? Or?
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
All right, I just wanted to ask you what your life was like once you returned from the war.
Well, after return, I went straight into university on a double degree in arts and law, so that was fine. So I was, only trouble is when I got out of university, I had to find a place to article. And there are so many of us getting out of law school that time, it's hard to find someone to take us in. So I tramped all around Vancouver and finally got a chap to take me in, and he took me in and signed my article papers. That was fine. And then after about 3 months, he died. Oh boy, I'm back on the street again. So I went in and saw the treasurer, who was the head of the bar. Why a president and the head of a bar? It's a treasurer. Lawyers are always different. And so he says, there's a man up in Powell River, Larry Eckert, will take a student in. So went to Powell River, took Ines up there to Powell River, and that she had a sister there, so that worked out fairly well. The only trouble is I took her away from Vancouver where she was singing. She's a coloratura soprano. She used to sing on the CBC radio and sing at concerts, or war bond drives. I think the most people she ever sang to was at Boeing's where she worked. I think they had 10,000 people there at about 3,500 a shift.
Wow.
And they had her singing one day in this huge hangar to a group that were celebrating something, you know, but she did a lot of singing. She was a good coloratura soprano, excellent as well.
Did you talk about your war experience very much after the war? Did you talk about your experience much after the war?
No, not afterwards. I was upset about killing people, although I could rationalize it, and did rationalize it. But I can understand now why people going to Afghanistan, these other places, having this particular problem. Mm-hmm. It is a problem. I think human beings are meant to cooperate and live with one another rather than doing the very opposite around the world.
Yeah. How would you say that the war impacted your life?
Oh, I guess if the war hadn't come along, I would be a druggist. I'd be a pharmaceutical chemist today. That was what I was going to train for in the beginning. I made a bunch of people in Courtney High School, a bunch of kids, take Latin. First time they ever took Latin in their lives. Because Ernie Costain, the new principal, came up there and he taught and knew how to teach Latin. Great. He said, "I'll teach Latin here if you'll go out and get five kids. Take Latin with you." I said, "Sure, okay. Come on, guys, it's easy. Latin's easy. Way easier than French, you know. Way easier. Just easy stuff." "Oh, yeah, okay."
Is there anything else?
No.
All right, I'm just going to do some wrap-up remarks. This concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Bert Matthews on March 12th, 2014.
Okay.